Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name's Todd, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm alive tonight and sober by the very special grace of a loving God and the loving program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God that I'm an alcoholic. And if you're a newcomer, why, that'll make you want to puke. But if you are new, why, I just pray to God that you can keep coming back until you can finally understand why someone can stand at one of these podiums and be as grateful as I am. And I'm especially grateful to the committee for asking me back up here to Grants Pass. Grants Pass is very special to me for some personal reasons. And I was your Sunday morning speaker at the Rogue River Roundup in 1981. And so it's been just neat to be asked back. And I hope that when my very dear friend Dottie Shore winds this deal up tomorrow, that you'll all be here. Because if you're not, you'll have missed somebody very, very special. I'm not in a particularly good place these days. And that may be a little bit discouraging to some of you to hear somebody with 18 and a half years of sobriety say something like that. But this last 6 months has been one of the most difficult periods of my entire life. Because in November I found it necessary to leave my wife of 16 years. And it was only because of the program that I was able to do that. And my little daughter, who is 14 years old and has never seen her mom or daddy, take a drink of alcohol. And I'm more than proud to report that inside where she lives, she's okay with the whole deal. And so that involved a geographic move, and my wife and my daughter moving to San Diego tomorrow. And in March of this year, I had a six-figure income job evaporate. And believe me, that was something over which I had absolutely no control, because if there's the slightest chance that I can control anything, I will. That's why I'm always amused, rather, at the Serenity Prayer, because, you know, I've found out through the years that so many things that we hear that sound so neat are all written backwards. Like, love thy neighbor as thyself. That's backwards, you see. Because a human being, as I found of myself, is totally incapable of loving anybody until they learn how to love themselves. And we go out there, particularly the Al-Anons, and wondering why, you know, when we love everybody so heroically, they don't love us back. And I found, for me at least, that the Serenity Prayer is written backwards, too. In fact, if you're really an alcoholic, a real alcoholic, why, you dare not pray for serenity, because I have to promise you that the first time you wake up totally serene, you will swear you are in a suicidal depression. See, because nothing is happening in serenity. See, if you really want to know what the difference between serenity is and all the other choices, why, you know, how many of you have thanked your arm today? See, your arm is happy, joyous, and free, and it's serene. And, you know, it just hangs there from your shoulder, and you don't even appreciate it. But if you really want to know the difference, why, go slam it in a door. Hey? I love the people that say, well, you know, I got the first two parts of the Serenity Prayer okay, but it's that third part that trips me up. See, well, actually, the Serenity Prayer is a prayer for pain. See, what the Serenity Prayer really says is, grant me the pain of doing whatever is necessary, see, so that I will know beyond a shadow of a doubt what I can change and what I can't change. so that I then may pray. Thank you for the courage to change what I now know I can change, like a tire. Or pray for the serenity to accept what I now know I cannot change. You know, it's like a brain surgeon probing for a bullet in the brain, and he's using all his experience, strength, and hope, and all of his vast knowledge to reach the site of the wound. And then after all of that labor of love and dedication and application of his God-given talents, he reaches the point where he must now make the decision. Can I move it without permanent and irreversible brain damage? Or must I leave it and accept what no power, no human power can change? And so it was with my marriage, and there was no high drama or intrigue. It was just a matter of survival, I have to tell you that. And so it was with the job. But you know, I have to report that through all of this, when I check inside where I live today, almost all of the time, I'm comfortable with me. And I can tell you why. I can tell you why. See, when I went to the very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was April Fool's Day, which is a good day for me, of 1968. And when I went to that meeting, I met a man. One of a great many, but he's a man that I've remembered through the years. When the heat's on, the hammer's down, and he's sitting here tonight, and liking to stand up. His name's Ed Frank. Ed, would you stand up? See, Ed's 27 years sober. And I watched Ed walk through the fires of hell in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw him go through the good stuff and the bad stuff, and I found out years ago that there's only two things that can happen when a human being meets the fire. Only two things. They're either destroyed or they're tempered. And the only thing that makes a difference is what they're made out of inside. What they've got going for them. And I never watched those guys that stood up at the podiums and said, "Well, everything's just fine. I have such a wonderful program. It really works." See, I watched guys like Ed with 20 and 30 years of sobriety that had their whole world caving in around them, and they were still doing the one thing I'd wanted to do all my life, which was just step out easy. Just step out easy. And they're the ones I watched. And they're the ones I took my program for. And they're the ones to whom I'll be forever grateful. Because I've been tempered. And I know, you see, that it is going to be all right. Because it's been all right for over 18 years. No matter what's been going on. And the great paradox of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we finally find that it is indeed okay, even when it's not okay. And if you can figure that out, you're way ahead of me. I was born an alcoholic, and the reason I know that is the first word my mother said was, "My God, you see how much you drank?" I was only 3 minutes old, but I was born with all of the personal attributes that it takes to become a real professional. A resentment against everything, a big chip on my shoulder, a big mouth, and an insatiable thirst. And my parents yelled at me for all the time that they were alive, from the very beginning. "Why do you have to drink so much?" And it didn't matter what I was drinking. I'm just thirsty. I can still get through a six-pack of Coke just as fast as I used to get through a six-pack of Cutty Sark. And I didn't know why I drank. I didn't know. I know today. I found out from Joe McQueenie and Charlie from Little Rock, Arkansas, why I drank alcohol. And I only found this out last year. See, I heard all these other reasons for drinking alcohol, but what I found out from Joe and Charlie from Little Rock, Arkansas, was that the reason that I drank alcohol was because of the 12 promises in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard them do this, but I'm going to do it because I love it. And most people are saying, "He drank because of the 12 promises on page 83 and 84. You've all heard them. But here's what happened to me when I drank alcohol. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would know a new freedom and a new happiness. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would comprehend the word serenity and I would know peace." Whenever I drank alcohol, no matter how far down the scale I had gone, I could see how my experience would benefit others. Whenever I drank alcohol, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity would disappear. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows, particularly the broads. Whenever I drank alcohol, self-seeking would slip away. Whenever I drank alcohol, my whole attitude and outlook upon life would change. Whenever I drank alcohol, fear of people and economic insecurity would leave me. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. Whenever I drank alcohol, I would suddenly realize that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. And isn't it an incredible gift of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can stand here tonight experiencing every one of those 12 promises that were the very reason that I drank because of the program? You see, I can feel exactly the same way. I have to report that most of the time these days, I feel like I used to right after I'd finished 3 martinis, doubles. You know, when he reached that point where the alky thinks, God, this is it. If I can just stay here the rest of my life. And then we make that cardinal error, we think. And we think, I wonder, if I feel this good after 3, maybe another 5th wouldn't hurt. Yeah, I'm always amazed at that part of chapter 3 where they say medical science has not yet found a way to turn drinkers of our type into normal drinkers. I suspect they're talking about social drinkers. And I'm really not looking forward to the time when medical science develops a pill that'll make me a social drinker. You know, because then I'm going to wonder if one pill will make me social. I'll have 4 gross. In the first place, I don't think anything that you try to control can be enjoyed. I just drank to be out of control completely, and I almost always made it. In fact, I don't understand social drinkers. I really don't believe they ought to be allowed to drink. You know, and they don't know a damn thing about it, and they waste so much. You know, I had a secretary for 7 years, and she was a social drinker. Made me crazy. You know, and we'd go to lunch, and almost every time we'd be at lunch, she'd get this glassy look in her eyes like she was having a spiritual awakening. I knew what was coming, and she'd say, you know, I feel like a glass of wine. And I'd say, why? She'd say, oh, don't start that. And I said, seriously, one of these days I'm going to do an academic paper on the thought process that an otherwise normal human being goes through to arrive at the conclusion that one of anything's worth a damn. You know, let alone 1 glass of wine, and then they sit there and drink half of it. You can just see it evaporating, you know. And they say things like, oh, that has such a delightful bouquet. The only time I ever had an opportunity to enjoy the bouquet was on its way back up. And I said, for God's sake, why don't you drink the rest of it? She said, oh, no, if I do, it might make me dizzy. They are weird. Just at that moment, when it starts to do what it was designed for chemically, they quit. And so all those promises came true for me when I drank. And I started drinking from when I was 16 years old, and I drank for 23 years. And I was a pig. I drank everything I could, wherever I could, whenever I could, as fast as I could, as much as I could, preferably yours. And my brother turned out to be some sort of a periodic, and they are really funny. I mean, he'd just get smashed on a New Year's Eve, you know, and just, and then he'd say, I'm never going to do that again, and he wouldn't. Weird. But alcohol allowed me a freedom from all fear that I never dreamed possible. And I guess the best way to describe the way I drank was to describe one day in the drinking life of Big Ted. And it always started at lunchtime. And I knew when lunch was because I was suffering from a nervous affliction at that time that I call the flyaways. I don't know if any of you have ever had that, but my secretary would bring me something to sign, and I'd start to sign it, and right in the middle of my signature, my pen would fly across the room. And I knew that if I didn't go to lunch now, I'd fly across the room in 8 million pieces, and anybody going to put me back together. Sometimes lunch was way late in the day, 5 after 12. Sometimes lunch came very early, 6. Whenever that pen went, I went. You walk in the bar and the scenario starts for the day. Now, you've been coming into this padded sewer every day for 10 years, but the bartender's got to be cool, so he says something like, would you like a drink? Are you kidding? What am I in here for? Well, you look at your watch, because you got to be cool. It only has one hand on it. So, yes, I have time for a martini. And just as he starts to turn around, you give him the real order. Make it a double, put in an old-fashioned glass, leave out the ice, and no onion. And that way you know you have about 3/4 of an inch of freeboard there, so when he brings it, you won't drown this brain surgeon next to you. Finally, he brings it into an ingenious system of geometric levers while you crank it into your face there. And then you say your first 3 prayers of the day. God, I hope it works. God, I hope it stays down. God, I wish he'd get back. I don't know why they're so eternally slow, you know. Finally, after an eon passes, he comes by again very casually, and he says, do you have time for another? And you got to look at your watch again, though, right? Say, yes, I have time for one more. The hand hasn't moved. This time, make it a triple, and finally you get that one down, and then that magic happens that I've never heard a social drinker talk about. All of a sudden, that God hole inside your gut with the wind blowing through it begins to heal over, and that ice cube with 8 million corners on it begins to thaw out, and you notice it isn't raining in your suit anymore. And then you look at that perfectly synchronized reflection of yourself in the back bar mirror. You pick up that glass that was incapable of holding a pen a moment before, and it's as steady as a rock, and you look at that reflection. Clint Eastwood, you devil. You have another little smash off of that, and you look down at this brain surgeon, and you say, what kind of day are you having, crap head? And it all comes together. And you're one with the world, and all fear of people, places, and things falls away. And you're able to step out easy. And the whole world is your pineapple, you know. At the age of 24, I was one of the youngest subdividers in Southern California. I was building over 200 houses a year. And everything was driven by the fuel alcohol. Already I was finding I was bodily and mentally different than my fellows, and my partner used to say, my God, how can you drink those martinis at lunch? If I drank one of those, I'd just go to sleep. You know what I said to him? A fellow like you just shouldn't drink. You're a menace. I had a charter member of the ski patrol at the age of 18. Never skied without being drunk. I was the only member of the ski patrol that wasn't thrown off for drinking. They thought I came that way. Learned how to race cars drinking, fly airplanes drinking, and I never drove without drinking. I always felt if you're going to drive, drink. Face traffic with confidence. You got to drink real fast there at lunch and get back to the office and work real hard because the cocktail hour is coming, and you got to get back over in that padded sewer where the big deals and the baby dolls are at 5 o'clock. You got to drink until the traffic clears, 10. Bartender can only make a 15-minute drink. I don't know why. Just the way it works out. So you drink in there for 5 hours, 4 drinks an hour. That's 10, that's 20 drinks. And now you're up there where your blood alcohol content's right at smooth. You know, 0.038. Now you only got one problem. I hope my car isn't stolen again. Beverly Hills Police Department told me that if I report my car stolen one more time, they're going to impound me. You get in your car, and now you have another problem. You got to drive home very carefully because by now you're driving an alcoholic car. You've seen them. They're long and thin. And they get that way from parking in narrow garages at high speeds. They have a lot of other character defects, you know, like the license plate hanging by one old rusty bolt and last year's registration on and the exhaust pipe dragging on the ground. That looks super at 4th of July, but you should wire it up with a coat hanger and, you know, and then the ones I dearly love are the ones that have red cellophane for taillights, you know. Now they got red backup lights. You don't know if those mothers are coming or going. Then they get these curious whiskey bumps all over them, these little dents, you know. Mine had them on top. And I found out that came from trying to open them when the keys were locked inside. And And then mine had a curious character defect. The left headlight looked straight down like this. That made it kind of neat because you could see the double line that way easier. You know, when it got foggy. Every night about 10. And so you have to drive very carefully lest the cops stop you because these vehicles are quite suspect. And this cop stopped me one time, and this is back in the days when they gave you the walking sobriety test. I wouldn't have a chance today with better law enforcement through chemistry, but those... Are you kidding? Driving all the way to Mammoth from Southern California, which is a 2/5 drive any way you cut it, and I was the one that used to keep the booze up in the windshield washer bottle in the front of the car there. I learned that from a real professional. We were going skiing one time, and I asked him if he had a drink, and mine was up on top of the car in my ski poles. I invented the drinking man's ski pole. And he said, sure, and he handed me this little hose out from the dashboard. And I said, what the hell's that for? I wanted a drink, not an enema. And he said, well, dummy, just put that little pipe in your mouth and pull the windshield washer knob. 2 ounces of Cutty Sark, straight up, man. You get up to Mammoth and you're so smoked you fall out into the parking lot. You can't walk, but there's an Al-Anon there in the snowbank. She's been lurking there all night waiting to rescue you. And she hauls you into the warming up hut there to get tuned up for the day on a half a gallon of Grenache Rosé and a couple of sardines. And then at 9 o'clock you find yourself at the top of the mountain with that kind of handicap. Some lunatic's nailed a number to your chest and you're entered in a downhill race. And somehow you get through the final gate there without crashing and burning up the whole hill. And this cop wants me to stand on one foot, put my head back, and touch the nose the size of mine. Are you kidding? So when this cop stopped me and they asked the lunatic questions, you know, your light's out of focus. I said, which light? Because you got to be cool. Out of focus. Are you kidding? It was shining on his foot. And then he said with this incredulous look of disbelief, he says, and you've been drinking, haven't you? Well, they already know the answer. They give it to him so they can pass the police test. 2 beers. And he says, I'm going to give you a sobriety test. I was so excited about that because I really, really loved him. I opened the door so hard that when he stopped me the next night, I thought it was a different cop. He was talking in a falsetto. And the second night he stopped me, he was incensed. Gave me a ticket for that light. What a boob. But you got to drive home, and so you got to stop on the way home and pick up a 6-pack of Cutty Sark in case guests stop by. And you get home and you open that bottle up there, and I never knew what they meant when they said, put the plug in the jug. I thought the cork was just to keep it from spilling till you got it to the car. And you pour yourself a great big huge highball there, about 8 fingers, and then you turn on your favorite TV program, Test Pattern, and put on one of those records that's filled with hope. You know, my favorite all-time artist, Ray Charles. You know, those great songs, Born to Lose, and It's Crying Time, and the Al-Anon song, Please Release Me. Those Al-Anons are so sick, I tell you. Boy, do they need this program. I found out their prayer and their salute. You know, their salute is like this. And their prayer is, God, if you'd only quit drinking, you know. And then we quit and their life's over. They got to run right out and marry another one. It was before the nail holes heal up. I know some of them that have married 5 of us. Can you imagine? And then at 6 o'clock in the morning, the alarm goes off and you're back up and out like a tiger ready to do it all over again, you know. I get out of bed in the morning, I got a high enough blood alcohol content to go to jail 18 times for drunk driving, and I'm wondering if I ought to have a little eye-opener, you know, a little bracer to get me started. And that's the way it went, day after day. And I only had 2 drunk driving arrests because I was a professional, and they were both bad breaks. Some of you had bad breaks too. By this time I was busy when I drove. I was building all these damn houses. I'd drive a little 56 Thunderbird and had a telephone in it and two-way radio and a dictograph so I could dictate all this gibberish to my secretary. And you smoke and you gotta take care of the ashes. You always gotta watch your rearview mirror so you know about the cops and so forth. And you have to keep one eye closed so you know which lane is yours. And, you know, you're busy. And you have this little hose hanging out of your mouth so you know. So I ran away from home to get married when I was about 30, and some friends of mine gave me a stag party down on one of those yachts in Newport Beach, and they were drinking my favorite thing that day, booze. And I don't know why the police officer stopped me. I was coming back on the Santa Ana Freeway going through Anaheim, and I was driving very carefully, you know, clear over on the right-hand side of the freeway there in the dirt, going about 5 miles an hour. And I developed a way of driving that was quite convenient for the condition I was in, and as busy as I was, I used to just lean my head on the door jamb like this. And that way you can kind of tuck the phone underneath your thing here, and your cigarette ashes kind of drool out, and the rearview mirror's right there, and the pipe's kind of hanging out of the other side of your mouth there. But if any of your friends are driving that way, why, I must caution you that they must be ever alert of one fact. Your lane is the one on the bottom. And so I'm driving along like this, and all of a sudden the gumball machine goes off in the back, and I stop, and it only stopped in 4 inches, and the cop came up. He had a great sense of humor. I said, "Why'd you stop me, officer?" You know, he said, "Well, we don't allow people to make movies on the freeway, and we thought maybe you were filming a rerun of Wagon Train." And then he did what I consider to be a terribly unfair thing. He opened the door, and I fell out. The same thing happened years later. I was in Glendale and left this fabulous party. Glendale's tacky enough, but I left this party at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had to drive very fast to get home before I passed out. And, cause that had happened too, and remodeled a dashboard with my head and lost my date and the engine came through the firewall, and that's inconvenient. And, so I'd been driving for an hour because it was 3 o'clock in the morning when they stopped me, and I drove usually right around 100 miles an hour. And I'd been driving for an hour, and I figured I was fairly close to home, so when the policeman stopped me, I was leaning on my door jamb, and I looked up at him, and I said, "Officer, give me a break. I'm only a couple of blocks from home." And he said, "Where do you live?" And that stumped me. But always being honest, I said, "Well, I don't know. You have my driver's license." And he said, "Well, it says here you live in Beverly Hills." And I said, "Right, nothing gets by you." And he said, "You're in Glendale." And I still don't know how that happened. Then he opened the door. Then I tried suicide. I came home one night, and there the animal was in the entry hall mirror one more time. We had a little meeting and decided to kill me. And so I went upstairs and dug my .45 automatic out from under my pillow. I kept it there because they were after me. And you don't have to be paranoid to know they're after you. I qualified expert with a .45. I hit what I aim at, and I jacked a shell in the chamber, took dead aim between my eyes, and blew a $90 mirror off the wall. Then I went to a psychiatrist because I was nervous. You know, I was dropping things and losing cars, and my pen kept flying out of my hand, and, you know, and I couldn't keep soup in a spoon, and, by this time, I was eating soup that was as thick as concrete, and so I wish you people would stop going to psychiatrists. I've determined that you people are the reason that they have the highest suicide rate of any professional group known. I mean, look what you do to the poor boobs. If I was a psychiatrist, I'd have a sign on my wall that said, "No drinkers allowed," or people with peppermint on their breath, either. And this guy walked in, and he says, "Well, why are you nervous?" "Are you kidding? I didn't just fall off the turnip truck. I said, for $65 an hour, you're going to figure that out." And he said, "Well, do you drink?" And I said, "Sure, I'll have a scotch and water." And he said, "Well, no, that's not what I mean." And the little vein on his head began to stand out. Anybody I talked to for over 5 minutes, a little vein on their head stood out. And he said, "That's not what I mean." He said, "How much do you drink?" I said, "I'm not sure. How much do you have?" And he said, "That's not what I mean either. Have you drank all your life?" And I said, "No, not yet." He said, "Well, do you dream?" Well, I didn't have any problem with step two when I got here. I used to sit in those bars and think up dreams to talk to him about the next morning at $65 an hour. Finally, why, after a long, protracted length of time, why, they get real honest with you and they say something like,
well, I guess I can't help you anymore. You better go to A&A.
Then they give you a little bill and you look at it, oh, $65,000, no big deal. You write him a check there and he calls the bank, it's no good, and he jumps out the window. Well, George, our speaker last night, reminded me of if you weren't here last night, why, it won't make much sense to you, but he described one of his driving problems where came around a turn on Vine above Hollywood and tore off the side of his car. It reminded me of a party that I went to years and years ago in Hollywood, and it was right after I'd worked late that night, and by the time I got there, everybody was pretty well smashed. And as I walked in, why, this one guy was telling a story about, we were all skiers, and he was telling a story about how he'd gotten snowed in, and when he got his car dug out, the snowplow torn the whole left side of his car off. And I looked at him and I said, well, you lying son of a bitch. I said, if you're driving a green Chrysler, the whole left side of your car is down on a big wide turn on Vine Street. I just found out last night George had torn it off. Because I've had my car run over by a snowplow, and they do not do that. And so finally, after I drank up $2 million construction companies and had all this fun, why, the end came. And I came out of my last alcoholic blackout, and I was in St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica. And I was in the intensive care unit, and I was looking up at my doctor, and he was crying. I could tell he was getting me all wet. They're more dramatic than policemen. And I looked at him and I said, why are you crying, Doc? And he said, because, damn you, you've killed yourself. I said, oh, finally. I said, why are we talking? You know, what killed me? And he said, same old thing, booze. I said, oh, come on, Doc, you've been telling me that for 10 years. And he said, no, you've finally gone as far as you... He says, you went too far, like you always do with everything. See, because all my life I lived right on the edge. Right on the edge. And he said, you fell over. I said, how's that? He says, God, you got it all now, Ted. You got alcoholic gastritis, cirrhosis of the liver, hemorrhagic pancreatitis. You got two ulcers that are hemorrhaging. You're bleeding from every opening in your body. Your blood pressure's 60 over 40. We've pushed 7 pints of your blood type, and the bank is dry, and that's the end of that tune. And besides, I said, oh, is there more? I was getting interested, because I'd figured out he was talking about me by then. And he said the most lunatic thing I've ever heard. He said, if you don't promise me you'll never drink again as long as you live, I won't even treat you. I promise. You know, if you don't know what blood pressure of 60 over 40 is, that's serene. Terminal serenity. Ten days later, I was back out in the street and I was drunk again. He told me I hadn't ought to do that anymore. And I was coming off that last drunk and I was in the skid row of my very own design, the old unfinished concrete basement of an old beat-up house hanging on the side of a cliff in Silver Lake. And it was all broken. It was all broken. And that's the best way I can describe an alcoholic who's hit bottom in all categories. All categories. All broken. See, broken dreams and broken promises and broken hearts and broken marriages and broken businesses and broken laws and broken contracts and broken broken bank accounts and broken automobiles and broken houses and a broken mind, a broken body, and a broken soul. And it was all broken. And it was all done. And in my hour of direst need, I cried out to the God of my childhood, and he answered me. And the only word that I remember, or that I recall, was the word remember. And I remember. I remembered a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd been to, and I can't tell you where it was or when it was, because I'd admitted 10 years before I got to this deal that I was an alcoholic. But see, all I heard at those early meetings when I went was that,
well, all we do in AA is you just don't drink.
Well, big damn deal. I had not drank for 2 whole weeks in 23 years, and life was unacceptable. That's all you did here, pass.
Hey. All we can do is promise you sobriety.
Well, I didn't know what sobriety was. I thought sobriety meant...
not drinking.
I gotta promise you, sobriety, other than simply and purely physical sobriety, has nothing to do with not drinking. That's a whole different deal. I guess I went to the wrong meeting the first time. I don't know. I'd gone to some meeting, and you were all old. You know, God, some of you were 40. And you're all lined up around the side of the room with your heads in your hands, and the lights were dim, and your life was over, man. And there was a skinny little gal standing up in back of the microphone. I didn't know she was there for a long time. She was turned sideways. Finally, she turned around, and I got a look of the full load of her, and I thought, my God, that'd be like making love to a gunny sack full of antlers. Then she said something like, if you want what we have, I thought, honey, if you got anything, hang on to it. Then she said something about not claiming perfection, and I said, you got it there. But I remembered another meeting that morning on that side of that bed, and I remember an old-timer in one of those meetings, and he'd come up to me and he'd said something like this. He said, Ted, he said, I think you're just chippying around with this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I don't think you've hit a bottom. But he said, when you hit a bottom that is absolutely necessary for every alcoholic, that he can conform to the admonition laid down in chapter 3, which says, we learned. And learning has to do with experience. It has nothing to do with what goes on up here in the head. That's just academic gibberish. You see, nothing means anything until it moves the longest distance known to mankind, from the head to the heart, from academic to experiential. And so he said, when you satisfy the admonition laid down in chapter 3, which says we learned that we had to fully concede total and absolute surrender to our innermost self as far in as you can go, that you're an alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. But he said one day, he said, I pray to God when you reach that bottom, either physically, mentally, morally, socially, financially, or spiritually, beneath which you cannot go. And for each one of us, it's different, but necessary nevertheless. He said, I pray to God that you'll remember there's a magic place where you can come. Where he said, I absolutely promise you that you can find a way to live your life comfortably with unsolved problems without ever having to drink again as long as you live. And where you will meet people, I promise you, that will end up meaning more to you than the members of your very own family. Because when the heat's on and the hammer's down and you need them, they'll be there. And they'll be there just for you. And they'll be there for only one reason. Only one reason. Because they care. And they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this magic place, he said, I absolutely promise you, you can find a way to have a God of your very own that you can take with you wherever you go, so you need never come back again. So that you never need be alone again as long as you live. And they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I came back that night to a little park on Roxbury in Beverly Hills where I grew up and used to play as a kid. And that's where I found Ed Frank and all those others, many and most of them gone now. With 20 and 30 years of sobriety, that walked the walk and talked the talk of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it seemed to me they wore their sobriety like a crown. And they were doing the one thing I'd wanted to do all my life. They were just stepping out easy. But they were doing it without taking any mind-altering chemicals or drinking any alcohol of any kind. And somehow in the insanity that was to be mine for a long, long time, I wanted what they had. And I came back. That night as I left that meeting, my God looked down on me. And he removed the obsession to drink alcohol from me forever, never to be returned. Now, I understand that that happens to about half of us. If that has not happened to you yet, I pray to God that you can keep coming back until it does happen, because it's promised in the magic book that it will happen. And finally, after a long, long time, with my back against the wall, living in physical sobriety only, it became absolutely mandatory that I take the steps that are suggested in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, or go mad. And I went to those old-timers to find out how this deal works. And since then, I've heard a lot of stuff espoused from the podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it worries me. You see, because in those days, the meetings used to be the program, and they aren't anymore. And we had the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. No, we don't anymore. There's a whole proliferation of literature and pamphlets and a whole lot of stuff. But for my way of thinking, and according to the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is only one way for an alcoholic to obtain and maintain his sobriety. And that's through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those old-timers told me this. They said the program is between page 1 and 163 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's all there is to it, and there isn't anything more. All the rest of it's fringe benefits. All the rest of it. And the meetings before the meetings after the meetings, the roundups and the conventions and the assemblies and all the rest of it, that's the fellowship. And I thank God for the love, the unconditional love and the support of the fellowship that allowed me to keep coming back and love me until I could find my way. Because, you see, one of the greatest lines I've ever read goes like this. When a man finds his way, the heavens are gentle. And the heavens have been gentle for me for a long, long time. And the old-timers told me that the book is the steps are divided into three parts. The first three steps are becoming willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. The next six steps are how you turn them over. And the last three steps are how you keep it turned over for the rest of your life. And that's all there is to it. And there ain't any more to that. And it's a very simple deal. And I hear these people stand up at podiums. They say, well, I take step 1, 2, and 3 every day. Isn't that wonderful? They're getting ready to commence, to start, to begin, and they haven't done nothing. In fact, you don't even have to take step 1 and 2. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you take step 1 and 2. Because in my book it says this. Right after that part of chapter 5 that you hear read at every meeting, it says, made clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic, could not manage our own life. B, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God couldn't win if he were sought. Not found, just sought. You know what the next sentence says? Being convinced of this, we were at step 3. Now, if you're not convinced, go get drunk. See? Go out there and get beat up on the street by whatever it is you do to be hip, slick, and cool till, by God, you're convinced of those three ideas, and now you're at step 3. There's one other way that you can become convinced. See, a lot of people think that this deal starts in chapter 5. That's like Joe and Charlie say, that's like sending a kid to his first class in mathematics, and they say, okay, now, kids, turn to chapter 5 and work the algebraic formulas. The first four chapters of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, including the doctor's opinion in the beginning, are designed for several reasons. The main reason is to convince me of those three ideas, to explain the exact nature of my disease and what we can do about it, to explain the problems that might arise in my path towards a power greater than myself in those first four chapters. The book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the basic text of our fellowship. And the reason I say that is because that's what it says on the first page. Being convinced of this, we were at step 3. That's no big deal. And then if you have the strength after that to turn the page over, there's a prayer for step 3. Now, there's a way to do that for an alcoholic. You get in the shower, lock the door, get in the shower, pull the blinds down, turn the lights out, and get on your knees, because it doesn't look good for an alcoholic to be on his knees. And you read that step with a flashlight. 5 minutes after a guy asked me to sponsor him, we both get on our knees in my living room, and we do that prayer together, because that's how it's recommended. in the big book.
Now, if you still have the strength after that incredible effort,
you turn the page over one more time, in the top of the left-hand side, it says an incredible thing right after step 3. It says the experiences we feel at this point will be short-lived, and that's not very long. Unless followed at once. Now, that's rather soon. By a searching, fearless moral inventory. And that means, get out the pencil and the piece of paper. I had a guy last Wednesday night come up to me, and he's about the same shape I was at 8 years, and he says, I've got to do something with the program. I said, how about taking the steps? He says, good idea. What do I do? I said, I'll tell you what to do. I said, let me think. I said, why don't you go home and make a list of everybody you're pissed off at? He says, why should I do that? I said, just go ahead and do it. The book calls them resentments. He uses long words sometimes in the book, like incomprehensible demoralization. That means you're screwed. So he made this list of all the people, places, and things that he was angry at and resentful at and pissed off at. And he called me back. I said, what do I do now? I said, after each one of them, put down the reason why. I'm angry at my mommy because she put me on the potty backwards. It's all right. He went ahead and did it. He says, they called me back all excited just before I left for Grants Pass. And he says, what do I do now? I said, now put down, which points out my character defect, which is. Okay. And he said, well, that sounds pretty good, but I've never heard of doing it this way. I said, why don't you pick up the damn book and read it? Because that's what it says. It's the greatest guide I ever saw for the inventory, why Joe and Charlie from Little Rock came up with it. You know what the guide is? A blank piece of paper with four columns. Huh? He said, unfortunately, I think that when they put the example in the big book, they had a help of an Al-Anon, because it looks like it goes from left to right. And only Al-Anons make lists from left to right. That's to confuse us, so we get angry, and then we can apologize to them, and you know how that works. But if you make a list, it's got to go from the top to the bottom. See? And at the bottom, if we finally uncover it, at the bottom of every one of those character defects, at the bottom of every one of those seven deadly sins, lies one horrible animal. Fear. Fear. I will argue with anybody. I love to argue. And if anybody has a better idea than what lies right down at the bottom. In my case, it wasn't fear, it was terror. And then we go ahead and we make another list of our fears and another list of our sexual problems, and we do all four columns. And how much does that take? I see the damnedest inventories you can imagine. Great huge autobiographies done on word processors with spelling programs. And I don't know what book are they reading? Yeah. Well, I don't know what book they're reading. It's incredible. You know. And then they counsel with somebody and they say, well, you have it all done now, burn it. And then you turn the page over a little bit later and it says, referring to our list, which you've now burned. I don't know. And then you share it with somebody, see, and then come home and turn to what I believe is the most magic page in the entire book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't remember anything that I've talked about tonight, I hope you'll remember the most magic page. You see, in my book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's at least one promise on every page. And they've all come true for me. On 83 and 84, there are the 12 promises. In the definition of a spiritual awakening, at the end of the book, there's a promise. On page 164, in a vision for you, there's more. But on page 75, there are 10 promises. And I don't hear many people talk about those. You'll read that page when you get home and only find 9. But there's 10. Now I'm going to tell you 4 of them. You can't get to page 75 by turning to it. See, because it's sandwiched right there in between step 5 and 6, exactly like what it is, a gift from God, and I almost missed it. I almost missed it.
It's the beginning of the whole deal. In that page lies the definition of sobriety. The beginning of the whole thing. It says something like this.
It says, we are preparing an arch through which we will walk, a free person. See, I'm free today by the definition in my big book, which says freedom is doing what I have to do because I want to do it. And there's nothing in this world that I have to do if I don't want to do it. I don't even have to go to the bathroom if I don't want it. I just stand here and let it happen. Of course, along with this, I have to be fully willing to take responsibility for all of my behavior.
He goes on to say that if the obsession to drink alcohol has not been removed prior to this point, it will most surely be removed now. It says something about the fear of alcohol would begin to leave us.
It goes on to say, so hurry on, lest the test come before you're ready. And the test is in the book. The test says this. There will come a time in the life of every alcoholic. How can you have a big book discussion meeting? Tonight we're going to discuss the word every. How about the word nil? Now, unless you're an academic mathematician, there is nothing that you can do with zero. I mean, nil, the results will be nil. That's just almost as close to nothing as you can get. Became willing to give up all of our old ideas. You see, now that takes in pretty much most of them. Jesus.
There will come a time in the life of every alcoholic where there will be no mental defense against taking the first drink. None! That doesn't matter what's going on up here, because that part of my head that knows up from down and red from green and fast from slow will be asleep. And it happens to every one of you every day. How many times do you drive along for blocks or miles, or in my case, days, and have no conscious contact with what's going on? And all of a sudden, you say, I'm in the wrong turn again, or wrong freeway. But my book goes on to say this. My book goes on to say that when that time happens, my sobriety will be contingent upon my spiritual condition. And that my spiritual condition is contingent upon two things. And it says this. If I am just trying to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my daily affairs, and if I am just trying to keep my spiritual house in order, I need never fear drinking again as long as I live. You may add one day at a time if you wish. But there's two hooks in that. I have to know what the principles are and have put them into practice in order to keep on practicing them. Huh? And I have to have gotten my spiritual house in some sort of order in order to keep it in order. And that is where we are in taking. I don't know anything about working the steps or working the program. It just says take the steps. Is that gentle? Is that easy? Take them. That's it. Lest the test come before you're ready. It goes on to say on page 75 that all fears will fall away. Can you believe that? Now, you won't know that until sometime later you screw up the courage to take the risk to do the one thing that absolutely terrified you and find out that through the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that fear has been removed. In 7 years on this program, I found myself looking straight down over the side of a parapet of a 27-story building with no fear of height. And I had terminal acrophobia. There was no way I could climb into one of those chairlifts or gondolas unless I was smashed. And once again, because that fear had been removed forever, never to be returned, I could return to the mountains of my childhood and climb into those gondolas and those chairlifts without having to take any mind-altering chemicals or any alcohol of any kind. And the fear of height gone. Only this time was different, because now I could take my little daughter with me, who was 5 years old then. We've had a lot of great time. My little daughter and I. 12 years on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was asked to be the opening night speaker at the Palm Springs Roundup on Friday night. And I stood up in front of over 3,000 of you guys and you gals. And in one glorious instant, I realized that all fear of people, places, and things had been removed from me forever, never to be returned. And so what you're seeing here tonight is the result of over 3,000 hours of stand-up public speaking experience, not only at AA, but at
all different kinds of levels with no fear. My God, what a promise. It goes on to say on page 75 that we will sense the nearness of God and we will feel as if we are on the broad highway with our Creator. You will have brushed the face of God. You will have established a conscious contact with a power greater than yourself. All right there on page 75 and six more promises. For God's sake, hurry on. It's your gift from Him. And when it comes to the amends, why? Put your name first on the list. Because for God's sake, whom did we damage more than ourselves? And I found out when I asked God to forgive me, and that I was one of His kids, like Chamberlain used to say, and that all He ever wants for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. And if I am anything other than that, it's... Well, I tell you, you know, I kind of know the difference between God's will and mine today, because I got a simple program. Mine hurts, His doesn't. And when I feel that pain in here, I know what I have to do. And after I asked Him to forgive me, why, I found that He would. And then I could forgive you, and only then could I ask you to forgive me. And if someone's died, maybe I'm only speaking to one person now, and you choose to make amends to that person, or someone that's unreachable, sit down with that magic pencil and paper and write them a letter. Write in the first person just like they were there, because maybe they are. All of the things you always wanted to talk about and somehow never had time. All of the emotions that you always wanted to share and somehow never could. In the first person, just like they were there, because maybe they are. And when you're finished with that letter, go to some quiet place and read it out loud. Just like they were there. In the first person. Because they could be. And when you're finished, burn that one. And you will sense an incredible miracle that you will know nothing about until you try it. And you can write that letter again. And again, and now it all doesn't matter anyway, see, because you're trapped in step 10 for the rest of your life. The first three steps are becoming willing. The next six steps are how you turn it over. And the last three steps are how you keep it turned over. And so in step 10, I find steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And if I miss one, it will not work. And so when I feel that pain in here, I must sit down and write about that, whatever it is, and make a little package. And then I have to share it with one of you. And now it's not so heavy. And now I can take it to my God and ask Him to help me with it in step 7. And every time I do that, whatever it is that's come up, if it comes back again, it doesn't have the force it did before. And if it comes back, it doesn't come back as often. And if it comes back, it doesn't last as long. But if it comes back, I just get to do that over and over until finally and at last it's relegated to the scrap heap of serenity forever, never to return. And that is how you turn it over. And that is the only way to turn it over and get rid of it. Separated by the little word and, when we were wrong, promptly admitted it, steps 8 and 9. And I don't need that step much anymore, and I'll tell you why. Because love, to me, is never having to say you're sorry. And what that means to me is this, that I love every one of you from the bottom of my heart to such an extent that I would never do or say the slightest thing that would harm any one of you intentionally. But not being perfect, if I should step on your foot in error, I have step 8 and 9 in the last half of step 10 to take care of it immediately. And so in step 10, I find the God-given tools that I dare not leave my home with any morning lest I need them during the day, that are absolutely guaranteed to allow me total freedom from all guilt, shame, fear, for only the length of time that it takes from the distance, from the pencil to the paper, and a loving heart of Alcoholics Anonymous, because my God is with me all of the time. Step 11, one of the promises comes true. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve the conscious contact that you made somewhere back there between step 5 and 6 when you brushed the face of God. Step 12, another promise comes true. Having had a spiritual awakening. A spiritual awakening as defined in the Big Book, which is a personality change sufficient to recover from the disease of alcoholism. A personality change sufficient to recover. We tried to carry this message. The message of our personality change. That's the message. And practice these principles. The principles of honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, because that's how it works, H-O-W, and humility. And I love the definition of humility in my big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's Aristotle, the great Greek philosopher's definition. Very simple and so gentle. Humility, the willingness to become teachable. And when I became willing to allow you to teach me, I found a way of living that I never dreamed was possible. And the heavens became gentle. I pray to God that each one of you here can keep coming back and listening to the music until you can understand the words. Listening to the music of alcoholics, maybe for the first time in their lives, they will laugh at themselves. The healing magic of the laughter and the love of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've seen help put back together broken and shattered human beings that no human power could have put back together. And the love and programs of Al-Anon and Alateen that I've seen put back together. Broken and shattered families and broken and shattered children that no human power could have ever put back together. The second prayer that they gave me when I was new was this. I pray to God that if you're new, you'll just put your hand in ours and come with us, see, because we've been there and we know the way and it'll be okay. But hang on real tight and don't let go, because if you let go, we're going to lose you. And we don't want to lose anybody, not anymore. And the third prayer, the really tough one, please pray, God, let us love you until you can learn to love yourself and the God within. So if you keep coming back and listening to the music and hang on to these people and letting them love you, why, someday, maybe you'll find yourself like I did, walking down the street one morning with my head held high and my shoulders back, once again a useful and decent human being with dignity and self-respect, and with a knowing capability inside for the one element that I'd never, ever experienced, the ability to truly love another human being unconditionally. And it kind of came together one morning when I was looking at the worst enemy I ever had in my life in my bathroom mirror and found he was my friend and quietly whispered just to myself, I love you. And in that moment, it moved the longest distance known to mankind from the head to the heart, from academic to experiential, and I knew here where I live that I was happy, joyous, and free. One of God's kids, the way it all was when it began, before it all got broken and shattered along the way by forces and influences beyond my control, to the point where my only escape and my only peace was in the poison alcohol, where I found the false serenity. So I pray to God that each one of you can keep coming back and get a sponsor and make the magic book of Alcoholics Anonymous yours and know it's the way. It's the way. And if you do that, why, maybe one day I'll get extra lucky like I was tonight. And maybe I'll be sitting out in the audience like I was tonight. And maybe one of you will be up here getting a birthday. No, it wasn't Dottie's AA birthday tonight, but I've been to hers. And if I get extra lucky, why, maybe it'll be your AA birthday. And if I get really lucky, maybe I'll see a tear in your eye, and I'll hear a catch in your voice, and then I'll know that you know. Because you either know in this life or you don't know. And there isn't any in between. See, I'll know that somewhere along the way, you fell in love with a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. Somewhere along the way, you brushed the face of God. Somewhere along the way, the heavens became gentle. Somewhere along the way. I love every one of you from the bottom of my heart. And please, live every day as if it were your last, and love every moment of every day, because there just isn't time to do anything else. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.